Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Today, we have something from the very deep past. In fact, it's so deep in the past to be almost inconceivable that we are able to talk about it in such detail. We're talking about the Uluburun ship, which sank somewhere around 3,400 years ago, near what is now Kash in Turkey. The subsequent excavation, carried out at a time when underwater excavation was a new discipline, had a profound change on the way that we understand the ancient world. It still remains one of the oldest shipwrecks ever discovered, and the entire story is quite astonishing. To find out more, I spoke with the brilliant Professor Michael Scott. He's an old friend from the history world, and he's just written a book called X Marks the Spot, the story of archaeology in 8 extraordinary discoveries. And yes, you've guessed it, one of them is the Uluburun shipwreck. So without further ado, here is the man who has captured the excitement of Indiana Jones with his stories of extraordinary discovery. Here is Michael. Michael, thank you very much indeed for joining me this morning.
It's a pleasure, Sam. Great to be with you.
Why did you write this book? Let's start at the very beginning.
Well, for me, we are in the world of discoveries of the past, and we spend an awful lot of time kind of thinking about the things that are found and what they can tell us about the ancient civilizations that they came from. But increasingly, and also at the same time, I must admit to being a big fan of Indiana Jones. And obviously, there's a new Indiana Jones film coming out this year. Kind of, he comes back aged 80, still being able to do what he can do. But for me also, the story was increasingly about how the things were found that we go on to examine and explore and try to understand. And those discovery stories, and indeed the stories of the discoverers themselves, I think are an equally fascinating and important part of our kind of past to uncover. Because at the end of the day, we can't look for everything in the world from the past. Every time we look for and find something, it is part of an active choice to search in a particular place for a particular kind of thing from a particular kind of past. And the more I sort of dug and discovered, the more I realized that is in no way just sort of simply, a random choice scribbled down on a piece of paper by the people involved. Often there are, pretty serious factors that are weighing in, that are encouraging, nudging, pushing, guiding, curating that choice towards a particular place at a particular time. Then there are the fascinating characters and individuals involved in the process who are often quite weird and wacky and wonderful. And then there's the actual story of the discovery itself. And that all came together. So I started investigating that. And then, of course, at the same time, you've got the interesting stuff that the actual objects or sites or locations can tell you about the past. But then I realized there was a third factor involved, which is kind of what's happened since the discovery. We kind of think of discovery as a eureka moment and then it's kind of happened. But what became increasingly clear is that not only does discovery sometimes take a while, you know, a number of the examples and the one we'll be talking about today, it was 10 years worth of excavation to uncover the shipwreck at the bottom of the sea. But then obviously there's a longer period of time even after that when they're analysing and studying the stuff to get it to open up and tell its story. But then that doesn't even stop then, because those sites, those discoveries, those ideas become part of a public imagination, that they're part of a public discussion, which never stops. So kind of the book for me was trying to do three things. On the one hand, it was trying to say, look, we need to be interested in the factors behind that curated and guided and pushed people to look for a particular past in a particular place at a particular time. We need to be more interested in the stories of the individuals who made the discoveries, and then also kind of the discovery itself, not just as a moment, but as a process. And then we need to be more aware of how actually what these discoveries come to mean, what they do, how that happens, both in the academic world and in the wider public world, and in how the two interact.
Yeah. Do you think that the kind of great period of amazing historical discovery has now passed? Do you think we're going to find more amazing things in the future? Or do you think it was all kind of, it was something that happened in the 60s, 70s and 80s when we started looking and no one really done it before?
No, I do think that, you know, discoveries will continue to be made. I mean, what I tried to do in the book is, the first discovery we focus on is that of the Rosetta Stone in Egypt, in 1799, really at the very start of the modern discipline of archaeology's development, really. But the last discovery we look at is happening right now, in 2022, 2023, on the island of Keros in the Aegean. So, great discoveries don't end. Yes, we don't have the stories in the same way of people going, I want to know what's in that blank on the world map. I'm going to walk off and discover and go somewhere that no one's ever been before.
Like Aral Stein in China or whatever.
Exactly. That kind of sort of... but what we do have is, at the same time, there's still an awful lot of past out there to find. and our search will still be kind of guided towards particular places and particular pasts at particular times by kind of this wider set of factors. And at the same time, of course, we've got technology continuing to evolve alongside that is making discoveries of more intricate and more kind of microscopic types more possible. And that means going back to some of the discoveries we've made in the past and thinking afresh about what they might tell us now more about their ancient worlds that they come from. But equally, it means we can have all new types of discoveries of things going forward into the future.
Yeah. You sent me a copy of this book and I loved it. And I said to you, let's do something that's based on a maritime theme. And you suggested doing the Uluburun shipwreck. But I should probably mention that there are all sorts of other maritime themes here as well, not least the Rosetta Stone, which we've just mentioned. And I don't think we can carry on and not talk about it. I should make the point here for our listeners that... found in Egypt during Napoleon's time there. So he had to build a fleet. He had to get his ships across to Egypt. We then chased him and then destroyed his fleet and then took all of the French spoils of war back to England, which is why the Rosetta Stone is back in the British Museum. So there is a fascinating naval history to that. So, Michael, just give us a bit of information about the Rosetta Stone and why it's important.
Yeah, so as you said, Napoleon chose to invade Egypt. Now, kind of talking about those factors of why Egypt at that point in time, partly it was because France wanted a counterpoint to kind of British power in India, and they thought Egypt was it for them. But also Egypt was rapidly rising up the tables of kind of serious academic interest as holding, particularly ancient Egypt, a sort of cultural, mystical, magical, sort of sacred set of knowledge that if somehow modern countries could access that or become the cultural inheritors of that, they could take on that mantle. And that's symbolised by, at the time, if you wanted to show that you were kind of a radical new thinker, you built sort of things that looked a bit like pyramids, in Egyptian architecture. And of course, there was no more radical place at the time than revolutionary France. So France was doubly interested in both owning Egypt as a sort of part of the great power game of that period, but also to become the kind of inheritors of the cultural kind of wonder of ancient Egypt. And that's why Napoleon, when he went to Egypt, he didn't just take an army in the fleet. He also took in that fleet alongside that a large number of academics. And they were called les savants, who were sort of spread across the different ships. So, you know, in case some ships got captured, he wouldn't lose all his academics. And so when he got to Egypt, they quickly got to work.
I wish people cared about it as much nowadays.
They got to Egypt and they set up, you know, a research institute in Egypt in the days and weeks following the invasion, and spent all their time researching stuff. And that was everything from discovering kind of, you know, how does a mirage work, to kind of understanding more of the geography of Egypt, to, of course, studying the ancient past of Egypt. And at that time, all that was really known was the pyramids, just about, and it kind of, but no one had ever explored into southern, into upper Egypt. And then, of course, this miraculous find came out of the ground when a bunch of soldiers were digging a fort at the town of Rashid, and they recognized that this stone had writing on it, and it was passed up to a superior. And again, it shows you the academic influence over the whole expedition, because the superior kind of recognized that there was Greek writing on it and that there were other languages. These were the Egyptian languages of hieroglyphics and at that time kind of unknown Demotic, and that there was a potential here for actually being able to translate between the three, because the person could read the Greek, and in the Greek it said, you know, the same text here is written in three languages. So this stone, rather than just being chucked in a building heap by soldiers, immediately gets passed up the chain back to the Les Savants, who are sitting in the institute, in their new institute in Cairo, and they get to work on it. And they get to work on it by making presses of it, so that they sort of copying the text on the stone. And they are immediately sent out to academics around Europe to get to work on trying to decipher it. But it would take another 20 years, long after the stone had been, as you said, taken over by the British and sailed back to London and installed in the British Museum, and a fourth language added to the stone when they wrote on the side, you know, this is a gift to the king, in English. It would take 20 years before kind of enough pieces were in place for the academics to actually be able to crack the hieroglyphic code and once again open up the language of Egyptian hieroglyphs, which of course had been read by humanity and understood by humanity very, very well. But with the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity in the 4th century AD, hieroglyphs had become a pagan language, and thus not one that should be used or spoken. And so humanity had collectively lost the ability to read hieroglyphs. And here was a moment and a piece of the past that actually enabled us to relearn a skill we had once had and chose to lose.
Yeah, amazing story, and also fascinating to see it there in the British Museum. And it also makes us think about the other objects in the British Museum. I'm thinking particularly here of the Elgin marbles, which were acquired at roughly the same time and carried back to the UK on British ships, British shipping as well. So always worth thinking about the maritime aspect of those collections. But now let's get to our shipwreck we were going to talk to. So you needed to think of, you know, several discoveries from the whole history of wonderful archaeological discoveries. Why did you settle on this shipwreck?
Well, I think this is incredibly important to showcase the moment, which, you know, was from the 60s onwards, when archaeology went underwater. And this shipwreck, the Ulubaran shipwreck, really sits at the very, you know, origin point of that story, but also still to this day is the deepest, largest scale diving project conducted with normal scuba equipment underwater. So it was simultaneously kind of right at the beginning of archaeology goes underwater, but still to this day stands as one of the greatest achievements of underwater archaeology, and has initiated obviously a whole new branch of archaeology as a result, which is now done to even deeper depths with submersible craft, and, you know, does the advances in technology can do even more incredible things. But I think this story is that perfect combination of human endeavor, tenacity, really at the very edge of human possibility and potential at the time, uncovering something which actually also at the end of the day completely revolutionized and opened up our understanding of the Bronze Age Mediterranean.
Yeah, there's, I like it. It's such a great story because there's a history within a history here. So obviously everyone focuses on the wreck, but I think the history of diving for sea sponges is amazing. And that's how we found the wreck in the first place. So could talk a little about that.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of actually sponge diving kind of within the Mediterranean, particularly off the Turkish coast, has been a long, long, long kind of natural employment for the area. And, you know, we have lots of stories actually before the Ulubaran shipwreck of sponge divers and the ancient past coming into contact with one another. And when you think about it, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? These guys are spending a huge amount of time on the seafloor. So they are going to come across bits of the past that have ended up on the bottom of the seafloor on a regular basis. And, you know, we could look at in 1900, for instance, sponge divers who were diving off the tiny island of Antikythera came across a whole heap of statues at the bottom of the sea. And at that time, 1900, the aqualung wasn't invented. The Greek Ministry of Culture had no kind of official means of archaeologically excavating what was down there. So they employed the sponge divers to do it. And they brought up a bunch of statues at great cost, you know, because of the depths that they were working at. Then in 1953, another kind of sponge diving, which kind of thankfully we don't do so much anymore, but it's just called dragging, where the ships just go with very, very deep a net, which is attached to a sort of metal bar that's running along the floor of the sea and just sort of yanking up everything that it finds at the on the floor of the sea, including, hopefully, obviously for them, some sponges, brought up a beautiful statue of Demeter. But again, it sort of says, well, you know, they weren't looking for it. And actually for them, it was a bit of an annoyance because it could tear their net and break their net. So it got dumped on a beach, thankfully then found by a passerby. And it now sits in the Izmir Archaeological Museum. So there's a kind of potted history of sponge diving and engaging with the past and sometimes actually being employed to find the past that goes through until about the 1970s, when what had happened at that stage was kind of there had been a guy called George Bass who was based in the States, and he'd been kind of trained up as a scuba diver and was one of the first people ever who was an actual archaeologist to go down underwater and work on finds in situ underwater. Up to that point, you'd employed somebody who was actually a scuba diver, kind of after the invention of the aqualung in the 1940s, to go down, bring the stuff up, and then hand it over to archaeologists who would then study it. But here we had a kind of unique moment in which actually you had an archaeologist being trained as a scuba diver to go down and explore sites in situ as they were found under the water. And during the late 50s and early 60s, this guy George Bass, had been involved in uncovering a shipwreck just off the Turkish coast at a place called Cape Gelidonia. And this was a Bronze Age shipwreck. And he realised huge potential here for archaeologists to be actually able to get underwater and look at these great finds in situ and be able to really do proper archaeological excavation discovery of these objects as they came into light. So he set up the Institute of Nautical Archaeology, but he realized that, you know, it's a big sea out there, and he was, you know, looking for needles. I don't know what the underwater equivalent is of a needle in a haystack, but you know, that was his trauma. And then he realized that actually if he worked with the sponge diving crews that were working off the Turkish coast, he could in an instant maximize his knowledge of what was on the seabed over a wide area, because, you know, he calculated that sponge divers on average over a cross of a sponge diving season were spending something like 10,000 hours underwater collectively. Wow. That's a massive amount of collective knowledge. So he spent the 70s speaking to every single one of the active sponge divers that were working from the Turkish ports and talking to them about the sorts of things that he would like for them to look out for. And of course, you know, these guys are not trained archaeologists. So, you know, it was a question of saying, right, OK, these are the telltale signs. These are the kinds of objects we might expect to find if it's a Bronze Age ship. And the particular thing that he liked to flag up to everyone was something called the oxhide ingot, which is a weird sort of particular shape in which plates of copper particularly were carried on ships in the Bronze Age. And it's called an oxhide ingot because it sort of looks like a square, but with its sides a bit stretched out and pulled out. And people thought that that was what an ox hide skin looked like when it was being dried in the sun. So these things are called oxhide ingots. And he'd showed pictures to them through the 70s. And then you get to 1982. And a sponge diver who was then in his 20s, called Mehmet Kakir, was sponge diving off the Turkish town of Kash, which is on the southern coast of Turkey.
Where I went for my honeymoon.
Oh, well, you know, you know it well then. It comes with a top recommendation.
I've been in that part of the Aegean. I've had a nice swim.
I didn't
find a shipwreck, unfortunately.
but there he was diving for sponges, remember? And he saw one of these oxhide ingots, although he preferred to call them metal biscuits with ears. That was his expression for them. And so he reported this up to his captain, and they reported it through to, by this stage, there was the Bodrum, a museum of underwater archaeology, which had just been set up. And that got back to George Bass and to the Institute of Nautical Archaeology. And so in 1983, the following year, they went for an initial inspection. And Mehmet was absolutely right. 45 meters down underwater, there was a massive haul of these metal biscuits with ears, oxide ingots, as well as innumerable other pieces of a shipwreck. And when they brought up those first initial finds, that dated it to somewhere between 1400 and 1300 BCE, which at the time was the oldest shipwreck that had ever been found in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, let's just talk a little bit about that period to give our listeners some sense of just how old it was. There's a wonderful bit in your book, and you say, well, it's 1,000 years before the Roman Empire, which I think really helps us put it into some context.
Yeah, it's a crazy amount of, we are talking 3,300 years ago. And, what are our expectations? We talk about the Bronze Age. We sort of have this idea of it's called the Bronze Age because people are sort of making bronze. But that gives us so little idea of what people were doing on the sea, doesn't it? And what people were able to do and how they were able to move about. And in particular, in this case, how sophisticated the connections were between the many different thriving civilizations around the Mediterranean and into, Asia Minor and into Central Asia that existed at the time. This was we're in the sort of latish Bronze Age period. So there are lots of amazing complex civilizations on land. But what the Ulubarun shipwreck went on to unveil for us was just how seriously engaged they all were in communicating and trading with one another by sea.
Yeah, extraordinary. What do we know about the... what do we think we know about the merchant who owned this amazing vessel?
So it took 10 years. I just want to for a moment, just pay a tribute to what George Bass and his second in command, Jamal Pulak, and the team did. Because for 10 years, they excavated every season. They did 22,413 dives, spent 6,600 hours underwater, all of that time working within a 250 square meter area. And they're doing it at somewhere between 45 meters and up to 60 meters under the water, because the ship was actually had come to rest at a 30 degree angle, and then of course over the thousands of years it'd been underwater, bits of it had fallen further down the slope. So this was an incredibly complex excavation. And my particular favorite reflection from George Bass and his team is that obviously, when you're underwater, you're breathing your air, and that's a mixture of oxygen and nitrogen, but nitrogen at depth is narcotic. And so his golden rule was that for every 50 feet you go down underwater, the narcotic effect of the nitrogen you're breathing is equivalent to drinking a gin martini. And so he was estimating that his team were working at 3.5 gin martinis down, repeatedly diving, year after year after year, to map every single find that they came across, to then draw it, photograph it, study it, and then slowly release it and bring it back to the surface. And it is testament to what they've done that the entire wreck, every single piece of that wreck, has been brought up and is now installed in the Bodrum Museum of Underwater Archaeology, where you can go and visit it today and see it brought back together in all its glory. So as a result of that, we've been able to ask key questions like the one you ask, which is kind of, what do we know about the captain? And you suddenly think, well, how are we going to know anything about an individual? Well, none of the individual survives, but a lot of the objects that those people who were on board the ship surrounded themselves with did. And we can distinguish a little bit between the kind of goods that were on board to trade and were being moved around and sold because they're in very large quantities and they're of particular kinds and objects. And we can have a chat about some of those because effectively we have the largest collections of objects, of traded objects in lots of different categories on board this ship that has ever been found. But then, of course, you find all the small objects or the one-off objects that speak to the individuals who were actually living on board and commanding this vessel. And crucial here are the kind of weights and balances. So these guys were moving from port to port and they were having to kind of ascertain whether the stuff they were buying, what it was worth, what it weighed, what that would be the equivalent of in a different kind of metal or material. So as a trader, having an accurate set of weights and balances was your absolute go-to object that you had by your person and you would trust in and you would keep. And people, traders, invested huge amounts in having quite personalized, ornate sets of weights and balances. So we have a number of little sets that have been found that are actually all kind of curated into and carved into the shapes of different animals, and one particularly nice ornate set that we think belonged to the captain of the vessel that are of Phoenician Canaanite origin, so that means coming from sort of today's Middle East area. So we're pretty sure that the captain of the vessel, along with a couple of other objects that seem to be his, like a very nice high quality sword, that's where he's coming from, where the crew is coming from. Then sort of other telltale signs allow us to understand a little bit of the journey of the ship as it moved around that part of the world, kind of on its trading missions.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's extraordinary. And I love the sense of the value of the entire cargo. And we haven't really spoken in much detail about it yet. We'll go on to do that in a moment. But there was this fact that it was equivalent to worth something like 1,000 years salary for someone normal living at the time, which is almost impossible to get your head around.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we come back to this idea. Hey, we have to remember we're over 1,000 years before the Roman Empire here. What are our impressions of what people were doing on the sea in this period in the Late Bronze Age? And here we have a ship. It's only 15 to 16 meters long, but it had 20 tons of cargo on board. Right, this is just one ship, obviously. Kind of, it's not done. There's no indication that this was a particularly unusual trading ship. This is just kind of one of the ships that was ploughing the seas, running between the different communities and civilizations that had coastal ports, you know, kind of around the eastern Mediterranean, and kind of collecting and selling cargo as they go. And you know, the total value of that cargo has been calculated to be, as you say, sort of the equivalent of 1,000 years' salary of your average worker. Or you know, you could calculate calculated it another way, which says that, you know, basically it could run one of the major towns of one of the great trading civilizations for a year, you know, everyone living in it. And so kind of this is a huge amount of wealth that is kind of moving around the Mediterranean, and which must have been sorely missed when sadly it sunk to the bottom of the sea when they kind of misread the winds kind of around the what's known as in the area, well, you probably visited it while you were there on your honeymoon, but Cape Ulubarun near Kashwish, yeah. We think the ship kind of floundered against and as a result sunk to the bottom of the sea. But lucky for us in some ways that it did.
I thought that the cylinder seals sounded fascinating. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so this was another of the kind of sets of objects that were found kind of within the ship itself. So you had the really big objects. So we just to sort of put it in context, you had those, you know, those big copper oxhide ingots, the things that Mehmet mm-hmm. first saw, you know, and there were 354 of them all neatly stacked. And then there was about another 120 tin ingots, because of course you need copper and tin to make bronze. There we go. So we've got our kind of big metal kind of ballast that's going around. Then there were 149 what are known as Canaanite jars, and these are massive kind of big jars that hold kind of some of them up to sort of 25 or more liters a piece, and they were all filled with something called terebinthine resin, which is kind of was used as a wine preservative, but kind of, you know, so that's that there's about a ton of that on board. And then you've got a whole bunch of what are known as Cypriot pithoi jars. Now, these are sort of bigger jars that are actually normally used as containers to put other smaller bits and bobs in. And it's in these kind of pithoi jars that we've got sort of smaller pots, jugs, wall brackets, glass discs, bits of jewellery, and of course these cylinder seals that are kind of coming from the different communities that the groups are trading with. And kind of as a result, it's this absolute smorgasbord collection of objects that are being moved around, you know, shove in. There's also ebony logs. There's ostrich eggshells. My particular favourite is there's a bit of elephant tusk, but there's also hippo teeth. And hippo teeth seem to be used as a sort of vaguely easier to work with kind of ivory. And indeed, there's one hippo tooth that's already been carved into the shape of a trumpet. Kind of as part of these objects. So you've got this absolute smorgasbord. And then in there as well, you've got pieces of jewellery that really caused a stir when they were found. So there was a gold scarab that was found that was inscribed with the cartouche of Queen Nefertiti. So this ship had also been putting in to Egypt. And of course, you know, being able to kind of align it with a particular ruler allows us to date it much more conclusively. Now, Queen Nefertiti was the wife of the pharaoh Akhenaten, who was ruling around about the sort of 1350 to 1300 BCE, which gives us a bit more firm date for when this vessel was moving. And kind of after those two, you get to kind of the most famous ruler of them all, Tutankhamun. So it kind of gets you into the sort of well-known periods of Egyptian history. But this, so, you know, you can start to get a sense of the range of stuff that this ship had on board of it. Everything from those big heavy duty copper and tin ingots all the way through down to hippo teeth carved like trumpets and gold cartouche, gold scarabs from Egypt.
Tell us about pomegranates, because they're interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, and alongside, we haven't even got to the perishable stuff. So, you know, alongside that, there's tons of olive oil, there's tons of herbs, there's tons of spices, there's all sorts of perishable goods that, again, you know, extraordinary. The remains of this stuff has remained on the seabed for 3,300 years and then was excavated carefully enough by the archaeologists working at 45 metres under the water to then be able to be analysed and discovered for what they were. And that included remains
of pomegranates. I've got a list of them here. Hang on, let me just come in here. Acorns, pine nuts, pine cones, wild pistachios, olives, almonds, grapes and figs, herbs and spices, including coriander, black cumin, sumac seeds and charred barley, as well as all sorts of other pulses and seeds, and as you were going on to say, pomegranates.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal list, isn't it, of stuff, both from the fact that it was on all this stuff was on board the ship, but also that we are able to actually technologically discover the remains of it 3,500 years later. And so the pomegranates are there, and you know, pomegranates are interesting because they're used for a multitude of reasons, we think, in this period. One is that actually the juice is used to sort of ensure that the perfume smells combine more strongly with oils, so that, you know, perfumed oil smells better for longer. But also they have a really important role to play in funerary ritual and in the afterlife. So, you know, these are not just your casual fruit that people are liking to snack on while they're sailing around. These are a high value good in and of themselves that have really important ritual connotations, as well as kind of expensive economic connotations for making that highly expensive, nicely perfumed oil, that kind of makes them, again, another major luxury good that is being carried around by the ship. But I think if we're talking kind of about things that this ship were carrying, my vote for the sort of best thing is possibly one of the unintended cargoes of this ship, because underneath all of this stuff and in amongst all of this stuff, the excavators working, underwater archaeologists are working 45 meters down under the water, 3.5 gin martinis down, also uncovered and were able to preserve and then bring to the surface and then study the half a jaw of a mouse. They discovered that this was related to the Syrian kind of house mouse population. So this poor little mouse, they think, must have crawled on board the ship at one of the last ports that it put in on. So again, it helps us understand this route. We've got the golden scarab kind of that's come up from Egypt, so we know the ship must have been there. We know that the copper, when we analysed it, came from Cyprus. We've got this house mouse telling us that it put in kind of near probably the Syrian port of modern port of Latakia. And then we have the snails. 32 land snails, or the remains of them, were found on board this ship, along with a couple of sea snails that had found their way in after the ship had sunk. But 32 land snails that, for different reasons, ended up on board this ship. And a number of them were stuck in all that terebinth resin that I talked about, that ton of terebinth resin that was contained in the Canaanite jars. And when they analysed the snails, and, you know, isn't this the joy of discovery, that there is something called the Journal of Molluscan Studies that is dedicated to snail studies? And they were very excited because they could prove that these snails came from a very particular area just north of the Dead Sea. Of Israel. So you kind of we can pinpoint the origins of the terebinth in resin thanks to these snails that got caught up in it, but also some snails that seem to have got caught up in the sort of brushwood and stuff that was used to line the base of the ship, kind of so that the copper ingots weren't kind of lying directly against the hull. And again, we can trace those as well, and they help us to understand part and parcel of the route of the ship as it sort of seems to have sailed kind of from the southern Mediterranean coast, from Egypt, all the way up past the Levant, all the way up past Turkey, and probably, as some further indications show, is heading towards the world of Mycenaean Greece.
Wow. All of that from this remarkable discovery. And Michael, thank you so much for sharing it with us today. And I'd encourage everyone to do what they can to find out more about it. Actually, is there a museum? Where is it on show? Where can people go and
look at it? Yeah, absolutely. So you can go and see the wreck itself as it's been excavated at the Bodrum Museum of Underwater Archaeology. But if you are a scuba diver yourself and you're taking your honeymoon or just a normal holiday in Cache, there is now the Cache Underwater Archaeological Park that has been set up, where they have actually created a replica of the Ulubaran ship and sunk it at a lower depth. So it's only about 20 meters under the water. So you don't need to be a kind of 45 meters down underwater scuba diver to be able to go and have a look at it. But you can get a bit of a feel for what it must have been like to explore this ship underwater.
Fantastic stuff. Well, thank you very much indeed, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now is the time for me to ask you for help. Please leave us a review or rating on iTunes if you're listening on an iPhone. If you leave a review, I promise I'll read it out. All of this helps us rise up the rankings and get listened to by more people, which helps us do our job to help those who do not know about it appreciate and understand the importance of maritime history. Please also check out our fantastic YouTube channel with its mind-blowing new material there, showcasing the maritime world in an entirely new way. Most recently, there's a fantastic little animation showing how composite ships were made based on the most beautiful hand-drawn sketches made by Harry Cornish, who was chief ship surveyor and artist extraordinaire at the Lloyd's Register Foundation in the mid-19th century. Please remember that this pod comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. You can find the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk, and make sure to check out their latest project, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera equipment. It's astonishingly good. Just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. And of course, please join the Society for Nautical Research. You can find them online. It's a brilliant way of finding out all about the maritime world from the very best in the business, and it's also a fantastic way of meeting people. So I very much hope to meet you soon at one of their meetings.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.